Maybe I gotta call Chuck up again.
You are on.
All right.
He's visiting with all my old pals. Back about the case. Talking horses.
The ones that never go for the average again, this one.
Yeah.
Which is a good horse to go for these days in North Dakota? 3,000?
These guys would be going to Dallas. I mean,
10?
I have an ATV.
This is Chuck.
Mr. Norris, this is the administrative law judge again?
Yes.
Okay, we're back on the record, and we're going to continue with your examination, okay?
Okay.
Mr. Deutsch, did you have additional questions?
Just a couple.
Go ahead.
Mr. Norris, I guess going to the 2009 Dakota Westmoreland Coyote Creek AVF study, at the bottom of page is 28, then going to the top of page 29, it discusses some wells that area the farmstead occupied by Casey Voigt. And going to the first complete paragraph on page 29, would you read those last two sentences of that paragraph on page 29?
I am a little confused. You're talking about the David Bickel report?
No, I'm talking about the Dakota Westmoreland.
Oh, the Dakota Westmoreland. All right, just a minute. I'm sorry. All right, and you are on page 28 of the...
It started on page 28 under the heading Existing Sub-Irrigation, then going to page 29.
Okay.
That first complete paragraph on the top of page 29, those last two sentences that start out, the landowner also reported.
Could
you read those two sentences?
The landowner has also reported well water levels at 15 to 20 feet. Root systems of the annual crops and forage grasses grown in sections 19, 30, and 31. Typically,
Mr. Norris, sorry, can you speak up a little bit?
Okay, I will try. I will try again. The landowner has also reported well water levels at 15 to 20 feet, root systems of the annual crops and forage grasses grown in sections 19, 30, and 31 typically would not tap water resources at such depths to significantly increase yields, nor would rangeland plants subjected to grazing.
Okay, with regard to that last sentence, kind of the conclusion that was drawn about the water tables being down 15 to 20 feet and having, and you know, with the result of that depth of water table, that would be basically insignificant to increase yields. Do you agree or disagree with that statement?
Well, with no more information than that, I can't agree or disagree with it, because the position of the wells being explicitly talked about there relative to where the plants are being observed or the hay fields are is not clear. The other thing that is important with respect to sub-irrigation is an appreciation of the fact that the plant roots do not need to get to the water table to have the water table providing them useful water. There is a zone of partial saturation that extends above the water table, and depending on the specific types of sediments and the grain sizes, the partially saturated zone above the water table can extend for quite a few feet, so that although the water table, if the water table were 15 feet below a terrace level, the crop roots would not likely hit the water table itself, but they don't need the water table. They just need sufficient saturation that the saturation is above the wilting point of the plant, and that can extend several feet in finer sediment, 5 or 10 feet above the water table itself. The crops themselves offer the best measure of whether or not they're getting that water. If you want to see whether the crops are getting the water other than their productivity, like a second hay crop or something like that, then you need to put in piezometers at the water table and watch for the daily fluctuations that represent plant uptake during the day. None of those studies have been proposed here, but the sentences that you asked me to read are certainly a caution. It says if there's sub-irrigation going on here, it has to be documented. You need be concerned if the water level is 15 feet or 20 feet below the land surface under the crops. But it doesn't preclude that there's sub-irrigation going on.
But doesn't that statement imply that at those depths that the root systems would probably get very little water that'll help sustain plant growth?
At the point of that well, perhaps. But as you move, if you're going to have that kind of depth, based on the incised nature of that floodplain, I'm guessing that those wells that are being talked about are near the creek. As you move away from the creek and the water table rises, then that depth to water at the well is going to vary and is going to decrease as you move to the edge of the valley. It's just one point, and it's a important observation, but the suggestion, the observation that the crops don't look as good near the lip of the floodplain, that's what this 10 or 15 would say. Yeah, that might not be surprising. But where the crops are still good, and you know the water table is going to be higher, similarly, that depth in other parts of that field are not going to be that great.
Okay. I guess along those lines, and that gets to the next question I have, and that deals with the diagram that you provided, what was marked as Exhibit 6.
Yes.
Do you have any data to show that that actually represents the conditions at Coyote Creek?
No, there have not been the data collected that allows one to generate such a diagram for Kiowa Creek. That is just a schematic of what would be expected in a normal floodplain with homogeneous floodplain materials that make it up. But to my knowledge, there have been no detailed profiles made across the floodplain anywhere in Kiowa Creek.
Okay. I have nothing further.
Oops. Go ahead, Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle.
Mr. Norris, this is Alana, and I just have one question. We're talking fourth grade level here, but I need to know precisely what your recommendation is regarding this permit and this hearing. You did answer Mr. Deitch and say you were not saying the permit information was deficient, so it was going to be one of my questions. What is your recommendation?
I would recommend that the issue of no alluvial valley floor be revisited, that the requisite data to resolve ambiguities that have to be considered existent at this point because of a lack of information that's been collected. I think there need to be boring and piezometer profiles across the alluvial valley system.
Could you repeat?
Change the schematic.
Excuse me, could you, before you go on, could you repeat that first sub-recommendation? There should be boring and what? Was that second?
Piezometer.
Can you spell?
Profiles. Water level.
Okay.
Profiles that will allow the water table to both be documented at a given time, but also documented as to fluctuations in the water table literally on a daily basis, installing pressure transducers that during August in September can look for daily fluctuations in the water elevation at the water table that can be indicative of plant uptake. You literally can have a few hundredths of a foot of water level decline during the day when the sun's out and the plants are taking water, and at night the water levels come back up and recover. It's direct evidence of the plants taking water from the groundwater. And you have then also the ability, when you put in those piezometers, to sample and describe the sediments that make up a profile across the Coyote Creek terrace, so that you can fill in the yellow areas of that schematic as to exactly what exists where in that creek. You've got an idea of the grain sizes that are applicable to the floodplain, so that you can then project the capillary fringe, the partially saturated interval from which the plants typically will seek to draw their water. You can fill in that schematic with what the real condition is, and that, I think, needs to be done at several places, not just on the Voight property, but other places up creek or down creek from that, to have a view as to whether or not the sub-irrigation that seems evident on the Voight property in fact also exists more extensively in the valley. My recommendation would be a detailed and meaningful investigation of data that is pertinent to identifying sub-irrigation. And that is missing from what's been done to date.
Thank you. That's all I have.
Commissioner Chrisman?
I didn't write it down, but did you say something kind of earlier in your testimony about a specific or different standard or requirement from OSM if AVF exists?
Yes, there are. There are rules. If AVF exists, then there are additional parts of the surface mining law that specifically address the protection of the hydraulic function of the AVF areas, the ability of those to, during and post-mining, continue to support the agriculture that they do at present.
So does what you just said mean that OSM would require that those lands not be disturbed or that they be restored back to what they are now?
The AVF rules would preclude, it's been a while since I specifically read them, but as I recall, they would preclude mining through them. But in this case, Coyote Creek is adjacent to, not within the footprint of mining. At issue here would be that the impacts of mining outside the actual mine area itself not interfere with the hydraulic function of those alluvial valley floors. The first step of the alluvial valley protection is clearly identifying whether or not alluvial valley floors exist. Then it goes into a set of regulations that, okay, if they exist, these are the following determinations that need to be made. And there, I know, are sections of exemptions that can be sought or declared for particular lands or something else. But any alluvial valley floors that do not become exempted from the protections, it isn't just the physical protection of the land from mining, it is a protection of the hydraulic function of those alluvial valley floors that make them work as a contributor to the agricultural economy.
So none of the areas that you're certain contain AVF are in the areas that are going to be mined directly?
I believe that to be the case, yes.
But just close by, so you're concerned that the adjacent mining will harm them?
My concern is that I believe there are AVFs there that are not being recognized. And by virtue of that, the investigations necessary to determine whether there is a risk to them have not been done. Okay. I don't have an opinion as to whether there is risk or is not risk at this point, because there is so little evidence that has even been sought for the determination of AVFs that I think that is inadequate. At the face level, there is, I think, sufficient evidence that I'm convinced there is AVF under the void hayfields. But the question of the risk to them would require yet further determination of what's going on out there. And so it's too early to say that I'm concerned about the effects on them. I'm concerned that there is a determination that they're not there.
Okay. And then this morning, Mr. Broughton put quite a bit of paperwork before us already. And in your testimony throughout, I felt you were pretty critical of some of the studies that have been done for just kind of recycling someone else's information, or not gathering information at the right times, or not gathering very good and accurate information. And then in response to Mr. Biela's last question, we find that you haven't been here at all. So can you just elaborate on that more, why I should give a lot more credence to your assessment as than what we should give to the other assessments that were handed out and were subsequently kind of criticized by you?
Yes, I would like to clarify that. The reports that were produced by Westmoreland and were produced for Coyote Creek by Bickel are not invaluable with respect to the issue of water availability to the Coyote Creek Valley. They do talk about the hydrology, and certainly summary discussions of the hydrology of areas adjacent to or obviously within a mine are valuable. And for instance, the Bickel report does summarize a lot of the hydrologic data that is hundreds and hundreds of pages in the permit application itself. And the Westmoreland document is the same. To me, the importance with respect to alluvial valley floors, though, is not the summary of the other data that's available, as valuable as that summary may be, but that data does not address and does not investigate alluvial valley floors, which is the issue I'm trying to testify with respect to. The overwhelming totality of those two reports is addressing, is there water available to the Kiowa or Coyote Creek drainage that that alluvial valley floors may exist. And that really is not in dispute or at issue in that there are all kinds of springs and seeps and waters that are described as feeding Coyote Creek and its tributaries. Coyote Creek, everyone acknowledges, has a perennial stream running through it. That then says, okay, we've got the alluvial valley sediments that everybody's there, says is there. We have a perennial stream, which is kind of absolute evidence that you have available water in that drainage. You have at least anecdotal acknowledgement of increased crop production. The only issue that really is there is sub-irrigation, and the Bickel report does not offer anything beyond the Westmoreland, Dakota Westmoreland report and the OSM. And if you look into the Dakota Westmoreland report, it too is discussing availability of water to the valley. But except for the walkover they made in May, it offers no direct observations or evidence of anything that addresses the question of is or is not there sub-irrigation that is contributing to the enhanced agriculture that's there. So it's not that those reports do not have their value. It's not that they don't give you an understanding of the relationship between Coyote Creek and the uplands. They do provide that summary information, but they don't provide information that allows you to say that sub-irrigation is not operating in that valley. If anything, at least for the void hay fields, what limited observations were directly made pertinent to that are evidence that enhanced hay production is due to sub-irrigation of those fields.
How far upstream of the Voigt Ranch is the origination of Coyote Creek?
I don't know. I would have to look at a map. I believe it's quite a ways south of the Voigt Ranches, but how many miles, I don't know.
Okay. I have no other questions. Thank you.
Commissioner Kolk?
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Mr. Norris, for your testimony today and your work in the field. Just some more background questions, if I could. It looks like in your resume or vita, you've got, done a lot of work in West Virginia. Is that correct?
There has been some very concentrated efforts that I've done in West Virginia, yes.
Have you ever testified in front of the West Virginia Commission?
Yes, I have.
What kind of proceedings was that, or what did that involve particularly, or in general?
It would have been hydrologic issues related to mining. It would have varied in some cases between potential damage to streams and stream valleys related to underground mining or mountaintop removal mining, geochemical issues related to groundwater contamination, reclamation designs and programs. There, in particular, one of the bigger projects that I worked on was a reclamation plan that would have incorporated coal combustion fly ash into the reclamation plan in an attempt to control acid mine drainage. A pretty wide range of issues.
All right, thank you, Mr. Norris. I was just then trying to relate that back to North Dakota. Would you agree that the mining, the soil types and the types of coal and the coal depth are much different in these two states?
Oh, sure. And the climate, of course, is dramatically different between the areas.
Okay, and then could you just clarify for the record where exactly the 100th meridian is? Give me some towns or something other than 100th meridian.
I, again, would have to go to a map and look for exactly where the 100th meridian is.
It seemed to me that was a critical point in your testimony about the 100th meridian and how that tied into alluvial value one more time, alluvial valley floors. So I would just like to get that location in relation to North Dakota coal.
Well, I could take a moment and look at a map, but the importance of the 100th meridian is that it is west of it, the surface mining law considers and defines, I mean, alluvial valley floors do not exist within the surface mine east of the 100th meridian. It is designed to protect the agricultural or the irrigation-dependent agriculture of the arid west.
But you see my question, Mr. Norris. We're trying to relate this to North Dakota. I just would, so that's not for you, I guess. But I'll just move on then. Commissioner Crispin kind of went down this road a little bit, but I want to just clarify. Are you questioning the data or the interpretation of the data or just lack of data?
Certainly. I think there is a lack of data, but I also interpret, or I also question the interpretation of the data. The issue of sub-irrigation under the Voigt properties, the pertinent data consists of what was described by somebody walking over the property in May. And that was the basis of the determination or the conclusion in the Dakota Westmoreland that subirrigation did not play a part. I question that interpretation. The description, the data that Walk delivered was a description that would be perfectly consistent with the geometry between the alluvial terrace and the creek and effective sub-irrigation over parts of those hayfields.
Mr. Norris, if I could just keep going, the when did you start your work on this project?
About 3 weeks ago.
So you feel that's given you enough time to fully look at all the literature that's tied to the history of this projects, this type of projects in North Dakota?
I would very much have liked to have had more data, more time, but it actually, I think, was adequate for the issue of the sub-irrigation finding. With more time, I would have liked to have looked at other parts of the permit. I'm comfortable that I understand what was in the permit application and what data was relied upon to come to the conclusion there was no alluvial valley floor.
And then, in general, for those doing research, wouldn't you trust the research of somebody doing a field study more than you would a report that you read? Wouldn't you rather have the determination being somebody that went out and walked the ground, looked at the soil types, looked at the flow, who had experience? Wouldn't that generally be preferred?
Boots on the ground is, given the opportunity, probably my first choice.
And then just a couple questions about your, I don't remember, your illustration of the alluvial floodplain. Would you say that, I'm using your chart here, the blue area, alluvium, is that a makeup of O horizon, A horizon? Which soil horizon is that made up of, or is it, or what is it exactly?
Without borings in it, we don't know, other than they are, there is a general consensus it is unconsolidated water lane deposits, but certainly the bulk of what we're looking at there would be below the typical soil zonation designations. Those are just sediments that are not, they underlie the soils, but the bulk of what we're looking at on that diagram would not be a soil profile.
Well, it has to be something. It's either a O horizon, an A horizon, an E horizon, B, C, or to the bedrock. It has to be classified as something.
Well, it would be a sediment horizon, yes. And I don't know, I'm not a soil scientist. I don't know what the designations of those are.
But you're drawing a conclusion, though.
I'm drawing a hydrologic conclusion.
But don't you have to know the soil type before you can draw that conclusion?
Not with respect to the schematic that I drew.
But you haven't done any borings out there.
No one has, to my knowledge.
But then how can you draw the conclusion?
There are basic principles of groundwater flow that have to be honored regardless of what the label of a type of sediment are. A gravel has certain characteristics regardless of the name that's given it in terms of a soil designation. A sand has characteristics. Alluvial sediments behave in a generally predictable way regardless of the label that's on them. You can improve greatly your understanding and the details, and if you had the borings and if you had the soil descriptions, the sediment descriptions, and the water measurements, you would almost certainly find that that schematic that I gave is very oversimplified. The water table would not be a straight line from one side of the valley to the other. It would have a topography, an elevation variation on it based on the sediments it's going through. But the overriding principle that will be there is that from the side of the valley to the stream, there will be a slope on the water table that is highest at the valley edge and lowest at the creek. And that's all the schematic is trying to show.
Understood. And just my last question, sir, if someone used a data set that had the different soil horizons that could clearly show the groundwater depth and use that in their determination, wouldn't that be considered the most accurate way to get a determination?
It would.
So far, if a certain group used that you would support that?
That is the sort of data that I believe, in response to an earlier question, that I think needs to be done for this permit.
Are you sure that wasn't done? Have you reviewed all the data and literature that maybe wasn't done somewhere when they did their determination?
I have not seen any evidence that was done in the area where Westmoreland came to the conclusion, Dakota Westmoreland came to the conclusion that subirrigation was not a contributor to the enhanced production.
All right, thank you, sir.
Commissioner Fedorchak.
Thank you, Judge. Thank you, Mr. Norris, for your testimony so far. Just have a few questions, follow-up, kind of summarizing your evaluation of the study of this AVF a little bit further. So I, too, am, you know, focusing in on a couple of the statements that you've said, suggesting that there wasn't enough info in the permit application to address AVF and that there was so little evidence sought in determining the AVF. I wasn't quite clear with Jim, Mr. Deutsch's questions to you in his reference to the pre-permit evaluation of the AVF. Did you read that?
Did I read what?
The pre-permit, the work done pre-permit to evaluate the AVF.
Well.
And what was that?
I read the documents that were cited as having been provided to the agency for the purpose of their determination. The original and the revised Bickel reports, the Dakota Westmoreland AVF study, the OSM 1985 reconnaissance investigation. Those documents which were cited in the permit application or mentioned in the permit application or were mentioned in the findings letter or were mentioned in the CHIA as being underlying the interpretation that there was no AVF, I did review.
Okay. And do you believe that summarizes what was all the documents relating to the pre-permit evaluation of the AVF? Are we talking about the same thing here?
Well, I think the pre-permit determination of no AVF also probably relied upon, for instance, the baseline data collected for this mine. I have no reason to believe that it didn't rely on the types of an additional material that was generically referenced but not specifically identified as to what was included. But where there was, they alluded to a lot of information without indicating exactly what it was they were relying, what those were. There were the generic statements that were repeated in the Bickel report and in the CIA that referenced literally everything in all of the agency's files. Obviously, I don't know and could not know what all of that information might be, nor could any citizen trying to review the decision. But where specific documents were provided that seemed to provide the core of the decisions, where the documents that were explicitly cited or quoted, yes, I did review all of those.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for outlining what you feel should be done in terms of the boring and the water level profiles and the, examination of that data. Can you tell me, is that the standard, the industry standard for evaluating the AVF? Is that what is typically done in these kind of permits, boring throughout the permit area to basically determine the depth of the water tables throughout the permit area? Or what's the standard for reviewing these?
Well, it very much varies from state to state, and it appropriately varies from mine proposal to mine proposal, even within a state. The type of data I'm talking about is being collected, has been collected. For example, at Otter Creek in Montana, in response to the agency sending the company back and saying you've got to collect the information that actually does this. So profiles across a number of streams at a number of areas were instrumented toward collecting exactly the kind of data I was talking about. At South Hart in North Dakota, there were, I believe, four or five piezometer profiles across streams for that mine that were installed and instrumented for a period of at least a full summer season into fall. At Alton Creek in Utah, there the alluvial valley issue was not so much hydrologic as it was geologic, and whether the sediments were or were not water lane alluvial sediments. So it isn't a... It's something that has to be defined and pursued given the geology and hydrology that's seen at the site. And I think the profiling that was done at South Hart in North Dakota and that has just been finished and is available for review at Otter Creek in Montana is the appropriate kind of investigation that needs to be done at Coyote Creek, for Coyote Creek.
And then in several locations in these reports, I'm looking specifically at the Dakota Westmoreland report, they reference water levels at 15 to 20 feet throughout. What are those based on, those references to the water levels?
What you're reading is really all I know about them. They are wells. They do not seem to explicitly identify where they are. They appear to be, in some cases, relying on anecdotal information from a landowner as opposed to physical measurements. They are what they are. I don't consider them reliable enough class of information to draw very many conclusions from them. It suggests that there may be areas that are below the depth of plant roots, but I don't know where the wells are, and I don't have where the wells are completed. I mean, it doesn't offer very much of an indication other than at the footprint of that well, alfalfa might have trouble reaching usable water. We don't have any real
to draw broader
measurements
to draw broader
time of year, anything that allows us to put it into a context.
Thank you. To draw broader conclusions about the depth of water tables, I mean, how much data like that do you need? How many wells do you have to? Can you fairly estimate in a broad area the depth of the water table by a few borings, or what's necessary?
Typically, when these kinds of profiles are made, the wells will be certainly hundreds of feet apart. You might have, depending on the width of the alluvial valley you're trying to investigate, 3 to 6 wells in a profile would be the sort of thing you're looking for.
And then in terms of the hay fields on Mr. Voigt's land, how large of an area is that you believe that there is potential for an alluvial valley to exist?
The only data that are there suggest that the appropriate decision is that there are alluvial valley floors there without detailed mapping, detailed crop records, further investigation. I have no way to estimate the aerial extent, the acreage that is or is not supported with sub-irrigation.
So you haven't narrowed it down to any specific
There are no data with which to narrow it down, of which I'm aware anyway.
Hmm. All right, and then in the Dakota Westmoreland study again, you had mentioned that the data was collected in the spring, which wouldn't be the appropriate time to indicate a plant relying on the water from an alluvial valley floor. I note on page 2 that the study says that it was used field investigations, interviews with producers, regulatory and land management agencies, published reports, aerial photographs, and Landsat imagery. Could any of that data have been used to draw the conclusion from this report that would lead them to, you know, the one that you object to, the two sentences you reject to, that the survey revealed that those plants nearest to the creek, you say the survey was done at the wrong time. Could they have relied on other data, or do you know that that's the survey data that was done in May, and that's why that conclusion is an error?
I think it's quite evident from the report and its leading up to the conclusion section, in fact, that they are relying on that site investigation. I mean, their number four conclusion discusses a depth of water table that exceeds 15 feet that appears to be an anecdotal evidence, and that the only other thing they reference is water quality in the vicinity of the homestead, which would make flood irrigating problematic, but that isn't the issue that's being done. As I read the report, they are relying on they're relying on that walkover for those particular lands, and not the body of data that you're talking about.
Okay, I think that concludes my questions, Mr. Norris. Thank you.
I have one more.
Go ahead, Commissioner Christman.
From your expertise, when open pit surface mining, like we do in North Dakota, is going to occur in a region with AVFs, what is your recommendation? Is it just a particular setback to leave a buffer zone to avoid damage, or is it specific mine practices that need to occur to prevent damage?
I don't like when we're talking about hydrology. I'm uncomfortable with general rules of thumbs or setbacks or things like that. I think it requires a mine-specific understanding of the hydrology, of the probable hydrologic consequences of this mine in its geologic and hydrologic setting, to determine what the appropriate mine design and potentially even location is in order to protect alluvial valley floors. If you try and establish a criteria of, say, an arbitrary foot setback or you're going to end up with situations where that isn't applicable for a particular mine in a particular setting. I think the objective needs to be a set of protocols, a set of guidances toward the investigation that leads to an investigation that then generates what's appropriate for this mine. And I think that's consistent with my understanding of how SMACRA works, is the mine plan has to be tied to the probable hydrologic consequences in order to make sure that excessive unallowable damage doesn't occur outside the permit area.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Broughton?
Just a couple quick questions. Mr. Norris, in your resume, which is marked as VOIT Exhibit 1, you list a number of reports and presentations and publications. When you're doing a report, such as some of the reports we've been discussing, if you have actual data that provides strong support for conclusions you're drawing, do you typically include that data or a citation to it in your report?
Absolutely.
And is that a standard practice in your profession?
It should be. It does vary a lot by individual and individual. Not everyone does. I think it's unfortunate.
And when we first spoke about preparation for this hearing, you told me that you would only testify if you could limit your testimony to specific areas, right?
Yes.
And that was specifically so that you had the time you thought sufficient to prepare your testimony in those areas?
That's correct.
Okay. No further questions.
Mr. Biello?
No, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeff Goatsacko?
I have one I want to talk to. Jim.
Sure. Commissioner Chrisman?
No. Nope.
Commissioner Kulk? Commissioner Fedorchuk?
Nope.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Norris. You can disconnect.
All right. Thank you for the opportunity.
Mr. Broughton, you can call your next witness.
Okay. I'm going to very briefly recall Casey Voigt for just a couple questions.
Mr. Voigt, it's my understanding that you were previously testified in this matter and were sworn in. Okay. I don't need to re-administer the oath. You remain under the oath, though.
There, is that better?
Mr. Voigt, I've handed you a document. The title at the top is Voigt Ranch Alfalfa. Can you just tell us very briefly what this document is?
It's a summary of my production records from baling alfalfa on those fields and also included some other reference fields further to the northwest that would be away from the Crick Valley.
Okay, and so which of these fields are in the area we've been discussing as potentially having alluvial valley floors?
The first two on the left, one is what we consider the field by the house, which is alfalfa, and then we also have the one by the scoria.
Okay. And do you know what the legal description is of those offhand?
No, I do not.
Okay, no problem. And then just generally speaking, you have two other fields, Brandon Corrales North and Brandon Corrales South. Can you give me an idea of where those are in location to the other two fields?
About a mile north and west, and then section 25, I believe.
Okay.
The first two would be in section 30.
And I notice on here for a number of these, especially in the house and scoria fields, you have a row for second cutting. Can you explain what that means?
Usually I try and start on those fields earlier because, as evident, every year I do consistently get a second cutting alfalfa. So after we've cut the first cutting and hauled the bales off, the growth is usually substantial enough to where we go back in and take a second cutting. On abnormally wet years, such as this year, we actually get a regrowth of third cutting alfalfa.
And tell us again, how long have you been ranching?
My parents bought the current ranch in 1971.
Okay. And in your experience ranching, is it unusual to get a second and particularly a third cutting of alfalfa in a field?
Yes, particularly on dry years. I have several neighbors here that can attest to how they drool over my second cutting on dry years.
And so in dry years in these areas where we've been discussing the potential of alluvial valley floors, even in those dry years, you're getting sufficient water to the alfalfa fields to get a second and possibly third cutting?
Yes, in evident on the production records in 2012, for example, to my knowledge, is the driest year in the history of our ranch. And I had, in the studies done by Coyote Creek Mining, pointed that out to Don Steffens, that even on a year like this, I still get second-cutting alfalfa off of these fields.
Okay. And do you maintain records of your production on an annual basis when you do these cuttings?
Yes, I do.
Okay, and to the best of your knowledge, is the information on this sheet accurate description of the cuttings you've had from that alfalfa field?
Yes, it is.
Okay, and I'd offer this in as, I don't remember which one we're on.
Would be 7.
Void 7.
Mr. Biella?
No objection, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeff Kotsacko?
No objection.
All right. Void exhibit number 7 is admitted.
And I have no further questions.
Mr. Biella?
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Voigt, looking at 2012, looking at the yield results you got there are substantially less than the, let's say, 9, 10, 11, which were very wet years, were they not?
Yes.
So wouldn't your greatly, it's by almost half or more, your reduced production in 2012 indicate a lack of sub-irrigation? You don't have the groundwater that's there to keep your fields going?
No, it just enhances it, and you get more when you have a combination of surface and sub-water.
I have no further questions.
Ms. Jeff Kotsacko?
We have no questions.
Okay. Commissioner Chrisman?
I do not.
Okay. Commissioner Kalk?
Just briefly, Casey, thank you for coming back up today. Just want to walk through, how does the water flow in your property? Is it northwest to southeast? What general groundwater direction does it flow?
It flows to the north, and most of it is from springs feeding the creek.
Okay. Do you have a general feel, or based on your time out there, how deep the groundwater usually is in different areas? You must have some wells that the family's used over the years.
Yes, there was one in the yard and one directly to the north of the yard, and I think the witness, Mr. Norris, had kind of touched on that, and I would have to agree with him that both those wells are located on the creek banks itself. They are, I think 15 was one and 17 was the other one, and then I guess it would be my experience from different seminars and stuff that I've been to that alfalfa roots will go to 20 feet and maybe even beyond.
Thank you.
Commissioner Fedorchak?
I don't have any questions. Thank you.
Go ahead, Commissioner Chrisman.
No, I had the additional couple minutes to think here. I'm not familiar with the Brandon Corral areas, but I am with around where your yard is in the valley. The Brandon Corral areas, those are hilltop, higher yes. elevation places. Besides the groundwater issue that we're discussing, in normal fields and in rolling areas, isn't there usually just better soil down in the low areas than in the high areas? And that when you're going along with a baler or combine, that the better production is in the lower areas?
Yes, that is true generally. But like for in this instance, the fields that we were talking about up by my branding corrals to the northwest is an area that the PSC has agreed to reestablish back to cropland after mining. And according to Don Steffen's summary of the soil qualities there, I think he said it was 4% less than what the other soil was on the prime farmland field.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Broughton, anything else?
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Biella?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, Ms. Jeff Kotsacko?
No, thanks.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Voigt. You can step down. Or, yeah, go ahead. Mr. Broughton, you can call your next witness.
Okay, our next witness is Steve Merrill, and he's the second one who will be testifying by phone.
Hi.
Is this Steve Merrill?
Yes, it is.
Mr. Merrill, this is the administrative law judge, and we've got you on the speakerphone at the Public Service Commission's hearing room. Are you prepared to testify?
I am.
Okay. Before we do so, I need to administer an oath, And in doing so, I need to advise you of the penalty for perjury in North Dakota. It's a Class C felony, punishable by a maximum fine of $10,000, maximum 5 years imprisonment, or both. And being advised of the penalty for perjury, do you promise to tell the truth in this matter?
I do.
Okay. Go ahead, Mr. Broughton.
All right, Steve, can I have you state your name and your address for the record, please?
Okay. My name is Stephen D. Merrill. That's spelled M-E-R-R-I-L-L. My address is 5317 Zenith Avenue South, Minneapolis, Minnesota, 55410.
Okay. And can you give us a brief description of your education background?
Okay. I received a bachelor's degree with a major in physics from Dartmouth College in 1961, a master's degree in biology from Dartmouth College in 1963, a PhD from the University of California at Riverside in 1976.
And can you give us just a general idea of the classes you were taking when you were seeking these degrees?
Yes. In the case of the bachelor's degree with a major in physics, the major consisted of physics mainly and a heavy dose of mathematics with some other sciences involved. And I sought quite a bit of biochemistry. In the case of the master's degree, it was a combination of both zoology and biology, biochemistry. I've also received a non-degree resulted training in biochemistry. In the case of soil science, that was core coursework in many areas of soil science and in allied areas such as biology, plant-water relationships, etc.
Okay, and following or possibly during your PhD, can you give us an idea of what you were doing professionally?
Okay, following my PhD, I shortly after, before I got my PhD, I became an employee of the Agricultural Research Service of the USDA in Riverside, California. And I was a junior scientist under the designation of a physicist. And there I engaged in plant-soil relationships quite a bit, soil physics work. Then I obtained my degree, and then I, again, working for the Agricultural Research Service, worked in Mandan, North Dakota, and retired from the Agricultural Research Service in 2006. But subsequent to that, or at the time of my retirement, I became a volunteer scientist with the, it's called ARS USDA, I'll just abbreviate it, and have continued that relationship as a volunteer scientist until the current time.
Okay, and can you give us an idea of what kind of work you did with ARS, what kind of studies and what kind of issues you were looking into while you were there?
Okay, I've done a wide variety of things with ARS. The very start of my term with ARS, starting in 1977, I engaged in a team of scientists that were involved with mine land reclamation in the state of North Dakota in the Zapp and Mercer County areas, and I continued that in a very active form until about the middle 80s. And after that, I was involved in the science of data analysis and paper preparation, and which is a really active form of science. You don't just have to be out in the field collecting data. And then again, in 2003 and 2004, I was actively involved in field studies of mineland reclamation. Off and on since then, in fact, even at the current time right now, I'm involved in the in studies of mineland reclamation, but not in terms of actively collecting data in the field. Oh, and of course, I'm involved in many other things within soil science: water erosion, wind erosion, crop root growth studies, soil quality studies. I don't know, things I've probably even forgotten about.
Sure, and you've mentioned, and maybe you've gone through all of this in detail, but you mentioned that after you retired, you continued on as a volunteer scientist. Can you tell us about what you were doing as a volunteer scientist after retirement?
Okay, my work as a volunteer scientist has mainly involved crop systems studies, the studies of how one crop plant, through its effects on the soil, affects the following crop plant. And then that has led to studies of soil quality studies. Right now, my main focus of my work is to take mineland reclamation experiments done in the 1970s and again in the 2000s, 2003, 2004, and to examine them for soil quality effects, to reinterpret this data in terms of the interaction between soil quality effects at one scale, at the agronomic plot scale of several meters, versus the functional hill slope scale of 50 to 100 feet.
Okay, well, let's get some background on that. You mentioned studies in the 70s, and then relooking at these studies in the 2000s. So, can you give us some detail about what studies you worked on and were conducted in the 70s related to coal mine reclamation?
Okay, in the 70s, there was a team of scientists established that had the, and they were given the main the federal research in the United States. The Mandan Agricultural Research Laboratory was the point laboratory for Western mineland reclamation studies. So we had a number of smaller scale studies examining specifically the soil respreading concept, what qualities and depths of soil were necessary, laying down the land to restore the soil to full productivity. And then we under the leadership of Dr. Jim Power, now deceased, we designed two very large-scale reclamation studies in which the main goal of the studies was to determine whether, if we, as definitively as possible, what thicknesses of soil material needed to be placed over sodic mine spoils to restore productivity. And these experiments were done, there were two of them, they were done in a form we call a wedge experiment, where a wedge of subsoil materials varying in depth from 0 to 4 to 8 feet was laid upon the leveled mine spoils, and then topsoil, typically several depths of topsoil, anywhere from 8 inches to 2 feet were laid upon the subsoil. So that was our flagship studies in the 1970s, these wedge experiments. In 2003, 2004,
Mr. Merrill, let me stop you there. I want to ask just one more question about these wedge experiments. Is it your understanding that these experiments were used by the regulatory agencies to determine some of the regulation standards that they were developing?
I believe so. They had a considerable impact. Not that they were the only studies in the United States or Canada experimenting with topsoil, with the depths of soil overlaying spoil, but they appeared to have a considerable impact.
Okay. And then you wanted to talk about the 2003 research. Before we get into the detail on that, can you just tell us what, generally speaking, the experiments were in 2003 and the purpose for which they were conducted?
Okay, the purpose of the 2003-2004 studies was to re-examine the wedge experiments, both the Zap wedge and the Stanton wedge, named for the towns near where these large-scale experiments were, to re-examine to see were we receiving the same productivity effects on the forage crops, but then we only had forage crops in the 2003, and this was 28 years after the 1975 start of the original wedge studies. So to examine what were the productivity effects in terms of were we getting the same response to the topographic lie of the land, the runoff effects. Because the original wedge experiments were made in the form of hill slopes. And also we wanted to examine the types of crops, the species, the forage species that were on the land. Because originally, in the original wedge experiments, we'd planted long strips of various forage crops. And spring wheat also. The spring wheat was replaced by brome grass. So we also had alfalfa, crested wheatgrass, Russian wild rye, native mix. We wanted to see how the species had changed. And, of course, you always have a change of these species. And then we also wanted to examine the soil chemistry, in particular the salt species, the salt loads, had the salt species moved around.
Okay, and can you tell us just briefly what were the specific findings after you conducted these experiments?
Okay, the general findings were I would say of the Stanton wedge. Was that the productivity in general increased up to a depth of approximately, I think the abstract of the paper says, 3 to 4 feet. But we observed a considerable, topographic effects too on top of that. Where the productivity would increase because of the typical hill slopes in effect were shallow, a grade of say 4% percent down to maybe 2% for the most shallow the least slopes. Okay, but at the Zap wedge we were seeing this tremendous topographic effect, where the productivity would increase up to a certain level, and then it would decline towards the summit. Now at the Zap wedge, we saw, especially with the forage grass crops, we saw that the topographic effects, runoff effects, especially in the average rainfall to better than average rainfall effects, were quite large, almost overwhelming. But with spring wheat crops, we got a different response because you see a lot of these forage grasses were dominated by cool season grasses, which respond to the spring run-on and runoff water. And also we theorize that, the newly reconstructed soil did not have the restoration of what we call mesostructure, root holes, worm holes, etc. And so that therefore the run-on-runoff effects were accelerated. And so therefore the crop effects would be more pronounced early on in the first. We collected data for about 3 or 4 years or so. But with the spring wheat crops, we were able to see the productivity effects of the increased depths of overspread soil better, because spring wheat is using its water later in the season.
So after having gathered all this various evidence and having relooked at these wedge experiments, it sounds like there's a lot of detail about the runoff and so forth, but aside from that, did you draw any personal conclusions about the soil health or soil reclamation in general?
Yes, because one of the conclusions we drew was that in the Reese study conducted in 2003-2004, that would have been up to 28 years after the initial reconstruction of the soil, was that the soil, it was apparent that the soil was functioning much better in terms of the near-surface hydrology. The infiltration of water, because the soil fauna and the root channels had been much better laid down, so there was infiltration was evidently a lot better, and so therefore the response of the forage crops was not as tightly linked to runoff effects, more tightly linked to the soil quality. And in effect, you could say it was more tightly linked to the soil depth effect, which is the primary soil quality. These experiments, in effect, were large experiments, large direct experiments in soil quality that showed why you have to study soils as a functional unit, meaning, say, the small hill slope unit.
Well, this might be elementary for some of us, but you're using the term soil quality. Can you give us an explanation of what is meant when a soil scientist uses that phrase?
Okay. Since ancient times, agriculturalists have had this concept of soil fertility. Soil quality, often referred to as soil health, is a modern version of the basic soil fertility concept. But by soil quality, we mean it's defined very, very simply and broadly as the capacity of a soil to function. That is, the capacity of a soil to support plant growth, crops, the capacity of a soil to not be eroded, the capacity of a soil to act as a regulator of the hydrologic function, to receive rainwaters, store the rainwaters, and to release the rainwaters. We have modern soil science has evolved specific ideas about what the components of soil quality are, both the biological, the physical, and the chemical. But there's been an increasing emphasis on the biological components of soil quality and understanding that the soil biota is what makes the soil a functioning, living, natural body, nearly living natural system.
Can you, and I think you've done this to some extent, but can you explain how the thinking within the soil science community has changed from the time you were doing the Zap wedge experiments until today?
It's changed like so much in science. It's changed in a radical way since the era of the Zap wedge experiments, the era that the that the woods experiments were designed, and the era that the Speckle law was generated. There's been a much greater emphasis on understanding soil, not just as a substance in place, but as a system. Soil is a system, and understanding that soil is a living system and it has a soil quality or a health that depends upon it, depends upon the plants on the soil. In effect, the plants that are feeding carbon into the soil are part of the soil system. And the microorganisms, the soil biota, is, of course, is the most important part of the soil. So, yes, there's been a tremendous change in the basic doctrine of soil science since those early days.
So are there ways to measure not only the mechanical and chemical aspects of soil health, but ways to measure also the biological aspects of soil health?
Yes. Probably the quickest, I would say that the three main determinants, main methodologies we have for you know, getting access to, there are many, of course, but I'll list three. Soil respiration, soil microbial biomass, carbon, and the ability of a soil to change the form of the nitrogen.
So if we wanted to utilize these concepts in soil health during the reclamation process, do you have any specific recommendations for testing and how we could do that to get a fuller picture of soil health during that process?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. I think, you know, soil has a system, given that soil is a system, that the land, the form of the land, has to be stable. And the physical to make a long story short, I think right away there has to be a topographic reconnaissance, no more than 1 year. It should maybe be 1 year after the new soil is laid down, but before two seasons are out, and specifically examination of the soil for sinkholes and in general stability of the landform, and a penetrometer test, the soil strength test, to detect compacted zones. That would be the first stage. And then the general soil reconnaissance. There has to be a general soil reconnaissance at some point after reclamation and after revegetation has gone on. I would recommend 4 years after, three to 4 years after, and that would consist of a resurvey of the land. You know, all of our lands in this country and all over the world are surveyed for the soil type, and that means examining the profile of the soil. Of the slope, and that means via a qualified soil surveyor, several pits examining the profile structure of the soil and corings to, I recommend a minimum depth of 4 feet. And at that time, the soil structure should be examined, the degree of root penetration of the plant should be documented. Also, a compaction of the soil through a penetrometer survey, and then early sampling, a grosser level of sampling, for salinity problems, so-called electrical conductivity, acidity, through pH. And at the same time, then a more detailed soil health examination of the upper foot of soil, and several layers could be done. As a minimum, I would recommend these following tests: soil organic carbon, microbial biomass carbon, infiltration, soil aggregate stability, and soil respiration.
Okay, and are there any additional items that you would suggest testing for to give a fuller picture of the soil's health?
Yes. What I've laid down is I consider just sort of a very basic minimal level. There are many other tests. PMN, the ability, probably nitrogen content, total nitrogen content, total phosphorus content. There are many enzymatic primary soil enzyme tests. There are some others, but.
Okay. Okay, I have no further questions right now.
Mr. Biella?
No questions, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeff Kotsacko?
I'd like permission for Assistant Director Dean Mose to ask, please.
Okay. Any objection to that?
No.
Okay. Go ahead.
Good morning, Steve. Dean Mose, Reclamation Division. What you're proposing, these studies, are you proposing that these would be done on all reclaimed land or as a research study? What exactly are you looking at or recommending?
I'll tell you what I'm recommending is that I think this should be done a study of the soil health in viewing of the what is the new soil and what is its health be done as a matter of course, because all of their the more modern farmers in this country and around the world study their soil health as a matter of course, and so therefore I just think that that mine land reclamation practice needs to be brought into a phase with modern soil science and it as it is applied to modern farming.
I guess no further questions.
Okay.
No. I have a follow-up to that. This is Alana Jeff Kotsacko, counsel for the commission.
Okay.
And this just stems from my lack of knowledge about what really goes on out there at reclamation time. Are you saying that these tests that you have just recommended and this analysis of soil type should be done, like as the company is respreading subsoil and topsoil at reclamation time, that's when you would perform these tests to see just what that soil is that's going back down in one location or another, which seems to maybe a moving target, but is that what you're recommending?
No.
Okay.
No.
Sorry.
No, I'm not at all. In fact, that would be, that would not work.
Right.
That would not work because ordinary soil survey and the examination of soils, these soils have been around for hundreds or thousands of years, okay? So we are creating new soils. We are creating new soils, and to be examining them as they are created is not going to work. But I think some reasonable length of time that should not be too great a length of time, say, I'm going to throw out the 4 years, we'll say. there ought to be a some sort of examination of these new soils. What have we got out there? Certainly after 4 years of time. And let me say that I realize that there are productivity standards equal to or better than before to see has the soil been returned to productivity by a yield test. And in the case of grasslands, that's in the case of croplands. But in the case of rangelands and grasslands, the test is productivity, cover, and the species diversity. Well, yes, that does indicate that the soil has been restored to some productivity, but these tests the yields can vary so much from year to year, and depending on the management is, you can get different results, especially with the forage standard. So there has to be something else than that.
Well, I'm glad you brought up productivity because I am trying to figure out now if you do these tests 4 years into after you've reclaimed and then 4 years into it you do these tests, would the objective be simply to provide the landowner or the surface user with better information for farming going forward because now you'd have the analysis, or would the objective be to change what you did despite the productivity records are over here on the other side, and we're going to be taking those for a number of years after reclamation. So would you, once these soil tests are done at the four-year point, are you recommending that then something be revised, different soil go in depending on what the results are, or just produce useful information for use going forward?
Okay. Yes, they would provide useful information, but they would also provide a public record of what kind of soil has been created. Much more information than beyond just mere yield tests or examination of the vegetation. And for example, if certain kinds of problems are seen with a test with a soil health reconnaissance. Soil survey and soil health reconnaissance at, say, the 3 or 4 year stage, one might detect the effects of management. How the plants are managed, how the soil is managed, can have a great effect, especially on new soils, how you disturb new soils that are evolving very fast. And so if certain kinds of problems are determined at, say, the 3 or 4 year stage, the management can be changed, and that would be very important so that the management could be made more soil building management. For example, if you have a piece of land and it's cropland and it's being put under, this is the worst case scenario, it's being put under spring wheat fallow. That means you've got a crop, you've got plant life out there every 3 months out of 2 years. The soil carbon is guaranteed to go down, right? So, I raise that as a worst case example of this, but.
Okay, thank you. That completes our questioning.
Commissioner Chrisman?
Is there perfectly healthy soil, or are all these statistics pretty arbitrary?
I guess I don't quite understand what you're saying, asking of me.
During the first day of our hearing, we had some dialogue about bond release and whether it occurs as quickly as it should or too quickly or at appropriate rates of speed. So with a lot of the things you've talked about and a lot more data development from 1 to 4 years after reclamation occurs, there's going to be a lot of more things to debate whether it's appropriate or not. And right. So would you ever find soil then that everyone would agree is correct, or would your suggestion just take us to a level of data to where no matter what soil you were looking at, you could find something wrong with it?
I don't think so. I think it's how the information is used, how the scientific, how the reconnaissance is used. If it's used, and I don't think one of the chief problems, for example, would be soil compaction, over compaction of the soil. If say soil health reconnaissance turned up compaction effects, and then deep tillage and certain kinds of crop plants that have deep roots could ameliorate that. But I don't see a soil reconnaissance being used as a way to change the whole bond release issue.
So if I'm understanding you right, then this reconnaissance, your objective would be to early on in the reclamation process catch whatever concerns there are and alter the management practices in the subsequent years before bond release to correct them at least to a reasonable extent.
Right, absolutely. And that's why... I believe the bond release period is 10 years in your state, and that's why the primary soil reconnaissance and soil health examination has to be done. You have to wait about at least 2 or 3 years for the soils to sort of settle in and see what the current stage of management is doing to the soils. But you shouldn't wait too long. I think waiting to say 6 or 7 years is too long.
I have no other questions, but thank you.
Commissioner Kalk?
Really.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Stephen, for your testimony. You're certainly an energetic soil scientist. I love to hear that. just a little background. So when you worked in Mandan, did you work with the soil conservation districts around the state as well?
Yes, we did work with them.
So in your experience, you know, I think we've got a pretty good data set of all the soil types around the state through the data sets that I think it's the soil conservation districts, all those different manuals. I mean, how accurate do you think our data set is of our soil types and depths in the state?
I think they're pretty well done. A lot depends upon what resources are brought to bear, and if you really want to know a given piece of land, you have to, as is done in the mining industry, you have to have a really detailed soil survey, more detailed than the type of standard soil survey.
Okay, because one of the things that this is outside of this hearing, but just general thought is. We do so much work with putting the coal mines back to the way they were, but as a state, we haven't really dealt into wind farm reclamation, and we're working on pipeline reclamation. So I do appreciate your testimony today, and that may help in a lot of different areas. But when you talk about soil health, I think I'm hearing you say soil health is different than productivity. Am I hearing that correctly, or are they related, or how do you view that?
They are related. They are related. A soil of high quality or high soil health, the term's interchangeable, will be able to support crops year after year without fertilizer, without a lot of fertilization. Now I realize that we have to have fertilization. You can't feed 7 billion people without fertilizer, obviously. But at the same time, having said that, you have to realize that a healthy soil is going to be able to not erode, to support crop plants without a lot of inputs.
So that's where I think I'm hearing, we're agreeing there, that I interpret what you're saying is that us measuring productivity is probably the best measure of soil health that we have right now with the current system.
Yes and no. The trouble with a productivity test, with just measuring yield, is that, I guess I'll put it in a kind of a crude way. I could take a parking lot, take any parking lot, cover it with a foot of good topsoil, put in some pipes, a pipe field to provide drainage between the soil and the asphalt surface, provide lots of fertilizer, micronutrients, and you can produce 100 bushels of corn. I mean, that is productivity. I realize this is crude and I'm kind of overstating the point perhaps, but I think you have to have, I think any viable system that moves forward is going to have to examine both crop yields, productivity, plant types, and the soil factors, soil health. The soil.
Have you ever, in the research you've done, submitted things to the national organizations or state organizations recommending changes in practices, or is this something you're just now getting involved in? Well, you've been involved in a long time, but have you ever submitted for changes anywhere in any bodies?
This is something that the kinds of thoughts I'm laying out for you right now, this hearing, is something that first occur to me in October of this year, when I went to a meeting in Montana, sponsored by the Western Organization of Resource Councils.
Okay, fair enough. And I guess just the last couple of questions, sir, is the... what is the depth of crops? I know you've got a lot of cropping research you've done. Give me your best guess of the root depth of alfalfa, maybe some other crops that grow in the central part of North Dakota.
I don't have a lot of work with alfalfa, but I do have quite a bit of work specifically aimed at crop root growth, the details of that, and probably sunflower and safflower. Sunflower and safflower crops, even in glacial till soil, such as found west of the river, can get down to 6 feet or more.
And then finally, you talked about that the amount of rainfall was maybe the controlling factor in production. How does groundwater tie into the soil health?
Groundwater ties into it in the sense that the cycles of groundwater have many different scales, and one of the at the smaller scale, the scale of say 10 yards, 5 yards, or 10 yards, the water that enters the soil infiltrates into the soil and moves parallel to the surface, and then waters the lower part of the profile. It's a species of groundwater, but at the smaller scale, and that is a very important part of the functioning of a soil. And soil is not just a soil right in this square yard or that square yard. Soil has to be in a functioning unit. And so, yes, the groundwater and the ability of the soil to infiltrate the water and to conduct the water in what we call subsurface flow is a very important part of a healthy soil.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Commissioner Fedorchak?
Yeah, thank you, sir, for your testimony this morning. despite being by phone, you've been very engaging to listen to. I'm curious about just following up on some of my colleagues' points and questions. What is, with your expertise, the best measurement of soil health?
Active soil organic carbon. That is the holy grail of soil health.
And how do you, if you were to use that as a measuring tool for reclamation, how would you establish the standard to be met on any given soil or in soil in an entire mining permit?
I think the standard has to be a moving target. I don't want to be offensive, but the whole what I call the magic numbers, the magic numbers thing has always bothered me. But I think that you want to establish some sort of a reasonable standard as a that the soil is moving towards acquiring active organic carbon in a way so that it's becoming like the pre-mining soils of that given the type of soil it is.
So you'd measure the active organic carbon at pre-mining, and then you'd have a post-mining standard that was the same that you'd have to reach at the 10-year bond release point? Is that what you're suggesting?
I'm not going to go so far as to say it has to be absolutely the same number. In fact, I think that would be a mistake. I think you need to have set standards, but you need to write your standards in such a way so that you don't paint yourselves into dysfunctionality, and I don't want to comment on the current system of bond release, but you know what I'm saying here. So I think you have to because soils are a living system. They're either staying about the same at a certain level, they are getting healthier, or they're going downhill. So I think you need to show that the soil is, in terms of its basic soil quality, soil health, is moving in a substantial way towards the pre-mining state. Mm-hmm. But I really don't think you want to get into absolute number standards. And let me say this, that the SMCRA law and the state laws, and we know that our state of North Dakota was a leader in mine land reclamation, right? But that was a long time ago. We had a much, different understanding of basic soil science. And this phrase, equal to or better than before, I think that is a wonderful goal, but I'm just saying there has to be some flexibility in the writing of these the code.
And tell me how you described as a gold standard of presence of active carbon. Tell me how does that show itself through the current standard, which is productivity?
That it shows itself that productivity, if the of course all the other elements too. I mean that is one of the principal elements of a healthy soil. But you can have a soil that has huge amounts of organic carbon, active organic carbon. But if that soil has high EC, high electrical conductivity, it's got acid problems. So you have to have a balance of all of the elements physical, biological, and chemical elements of soil quality for the soil to be a really productive soil.
So if I understood what you were just saying, you said that, did you say that you could have soil that had a lot of the active carbon but still wasn't productive because there was something else wrong with it?
Absolutely. Active organic carbon is one element. In terms of modern soil science, it's an element that is probably emphasized above others as a keystone, a keystone part, but it's only one of many, because soil is a very, very complex body.
Well, it sounds to me that what you're just suggesting is that perhaps the productivity is the way that you measure it to gauge all of those factors. It takes into consideration the chemical and the biological and the all the factors. It's probably the one measurement that does capture all of those qualities of the soil. Or did I misunderstand you?
Yeah, it can at the performance standards, but again, you can have a very, very productive soil that you can have high yields in wetter years. But that soil can be an unstable soil. It can be a fragile soil for various reasons. So I think you have to look at the totality of the elements of soil quality and soil health. I don't think over the long run that just having a plant productivity standard as the totality of the is going to work. It's not going to work over the. It might work in the short run, but over the long run, it's not.
Do we have proof of that in looking at some of the mine lands that have been reclaimed and have been bond released? Do we have proof of that, that this isn't standing the test of time, the current standards?
Okay, you're getting outside of my range of expertise here quite a bit.
It seems like that's exactly what you're saying, though, is that it might work at certain periods of time, but over the long haul, it might not pay out, that we should be looking at more things to make sure that the long-term soil health is stable and strong.
Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. I would agree with that. Yes.
So then if the current standards aren't proving that, then we should be able to look at mines, lands that have been reclaimed years ago and see that the land isn't productive and it isn't able to sustain crops or grazing. And so I'm wondering if we have that proof. I'd love to see that kind of data because I think it is important to look at that.
So I would agree with that quite a bit.
But you don't have any of that data yourself that you've seen or have access to?
No, I don't. No, I don't.
Okay. Thank you, sir, for your time this morning. I appreciate it.
Mr. Broughton, any follow-up?
Yeah, just a couple questions to sort of recap, Mr. Merrill. My understanding is that what you're proposing specifically is a soil reconnaissance, which would give us a more holistic and better understanding of soil health. Is that a fair explanation of your testimony?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
And do you believe, particularly in situations where they might be running into problems with the reclamation process, that gathering this information would allow them to identify specifically what those problems are and address them?
Yes, I do.
Okay. No further questions.
Go ahead, Commissioner.
Sorry, I had one other question I forgot to ask. Sir, is there anything that's so if the companies would do this, do you think that they would be able to achieve the productivity levels and get out of bond release sooner if they were doing this today, these soil examinations that you're describing?
Yes, they would. But let me add a caveat to that answer. Yes, they would in terms of strictly soils issues. But soil as a system, you know, you have to look at the hill slope or even the waters, the small watershed at different scales, and the hydrology of the soil.
Sure.
You know, at different scales, just the hydrology over the water flowing into the soil, through the soil, out again, in different scales is also part of the soil health. And any answer I give to you does not include any of that.
Sure.
And I'm not a hydrologist, but I've heard enough and know enough, and I think we all know enough that that is an issue that is connected with mm-hmm. soil health, but it also can be viewed functionally as a separate issue.
Is there anything is there anything that you're aware of that's that precludes the companies from doing what you're describing? And have you had any that have talked to you about it and expressed interest in kind of pursuing this angle to improve their reclamation standards and in their chances of meeting their 10-year bond release time period?
No, they haven't. Because I've only had this thought and since October this year, frankly.
So this is really new, kind of cutting edge concepts.
Well,
is that right?
Yeah, for me it is, and I don't know if other people are. I suspect that there are other. I would say that there is quite a bit of research within the soil science community. I know in examining these. Past mine lands, the new mine soils, and but I've only recently started to access this mine, you know, to read this. So
okay, thank you, sir.
Mr. Biella, any follow up?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Ms. Jeffcoat Sacco.
Mr. Deitch would like to ask one question. Please.
Okay, go ahead.
Steve, in your testimony earlier, then some of this other discussion, I guess I'm talking about changes over time. Going back to when you went back and looked at those 1970 wedge plots at Indian Head and Glen Herald, did you overall feel that there was an improvement or decline in soil health from when those studies were completed back in the late 70s?
Oh, I would say that our evidence, especially from the pattern of forage grass growth, that pattern, overall pattern, can be interpreted as a pretty large improvement in soil health. I should say that this is evidence, pretty strong evidence in my view, that the soil structure, you know, the ability of the soil to infiltrate the water and to carry it through the soil and not just have the water run off the soil had improved quite a bit. The establishment of wormholes, and there's all these other animals in the soil, the mesofauna that are digging holes in the soil, and then the plants grow and their roots die, and so you have these holes, and that's very important, the physical elements of soil health. So I think we have evidence that had improved a great deal.
Okay, thank you,
Commissioner Fedorchak.
I heard this earlier and I thought I misunderstood it, and I'm still wondering if I'm hearing this correctly. The wedge study that you're referring to, Steve, is a before and after of a mined area. Is that correct?
Let's see. Well, no. It was not a before and after. It was because the original wet study was on reclaimed soils, but they were reclaimed in an experimental manner. Did different depths of soil. And different combinations of topsoil and subsoil laid over in the case of the Stanton Wedge, it was a fairly newly mined sodic mine spoil. In the case of the Zap Wedge, it was an older mine spoil, pre-smacker of mine spoil. And so that was the original study conducted between 75 and, and about the 80, I think I quit working on that actively in about 81. And then the follow-on study in 2003 and 2004 was to re-examine these experimental reclamation lands.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Commissioner Chrisman, anything else?
No.
Commissioner Kalk? Okay. Mr. Broughton, is that it for the witness?
Yeah, no further questions.
Mr. Biel, anything?
No, Your Honor.
All right. Mr. Merrill, you can disconnect. Thank you.
Okay, I would like to thank everybody in the PSC and everybody involved here for this great opportunity for me to, because I think this has been a good day for soil science.
Thank you. I think at this time we'll take a break for lunch, start up again at 1, so we can go off the record. Mr. Broughton, how many witnesses do you have left?
Just one.
Just the one?